From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now! Crime, disasters, war, and terrorism average more than 40% of all local TV newscasts. We'll look at Rocky Mountain Media Watch's Mayhem Index. Then four executions are scheduled for Texas this week. We'll look at those and a teenager in Mississippi facing the death penalty. And it's called fraternization. Lieutenant Krista Davis faces 55 years for an Air Force love affair.
This is a dangerous place for women right now. And it's a dangerous place for men who actually support women and look at women as partners in the military right now, because the signal that they're sending out is that we don't want you. And it's a very traditional place. So the people who are in power are used to women taking a supportive role.
All that and more coming up on Pacifico Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Pacifico Radio's daily grassroots political show. I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate passed a bill yesterday that for the first time would ban a specific abortion procedure. But abortion opponents fell 3 votes short of the number needed to override the expected veto from President Clinton. For tricking Richard Jewell into answering questions about the Olympic Park bombing without a lawyer present, the head of the FBI's Atlanta office says he was censured. Jewell's attorney said yesterday the agents involved in the deception should have been fired. First Lieutenant Kelly Flynn, the nation's first female B-52 bomber pilot, spent the night with family, waiting to see if she'll be honorably discharged or court-martialed on charges of adultery and lying. Governor George Bush of Texas signed a bill yesterday that allows repeat child molesters in prison to undergo voluntary surgical castration, saying it's for people too sick to cure their illness. This news from Charleston, South Carolina. The interim president of the Citadel denied that the school ever condoned the display of Nazi emblems or regalia anywhere on campus and vowed yesterday to investigate all cadet mottos and creeds. In court documents filed this week, two students who graduated last weekend alleged that Echo Company, already accused of harassing female cadets, glorified Nazi symbols, with some members even displaying swastikas on T-shirts. Craig Belsol and Dan Eggers alleged that Echo called itself Der Stalag, German for prisoner of war camp, and said the company had a metal file locker with a picture of a young man giving a Heil Hitler salute inside. Members also used the phrase Echo über alles, a variation on Deutschland über alles, or Germany overall, and words from the German national anthem made infamous by the Nazis. And triumphant but low profile, Congo's new president arrived in the capital yesterday after a 3-decade battle to rule the former Zaire, now being called the Congo. His aides promised democracy but said the time hadn't come for competing political parties. And you're listening to Democracy Now!, and I'm joined by my co-host, a columnist with the New York Daily News, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Juan.
Thank you, Amy. Good day to you and all the listeners.
Well, good day to you, too. In the last few days, you've had a couple of interesting meals. Let's start with the one a couple nights ago where you heard Bill Richardson speak, the dinner of Latino officials and activists.
Yeah, well, Bill Richardson was the new U.N. ambassador, was receiving an award from the Hispanic Council on Foreign Relations, and he gave a pretty impassioned speech. He just, I guess, arrived back from Zaire, and I think Congressman Esteban Torres, who was chairing the event, mistakenly gave him all the credit for the peaceful transition of power in Zaire. You know, it's amazing how U.S. officials always get to a country to let the local dictator, whom they've supported for years, know that the lifeline is ended and it's time to pack up and leave. So, but Bill Richardson did it this time, and he also announced that President Clinton is about to make a bunch of announcements of Hispanic Americans to U.S. ambassadorships for the first time, several of them, which has never happened before.
Hmm. Now, we talked about another meal that you had. I noticed you haven't gained some weight. I'd like to know how you do it. But another meal.
I don't want you to think that all my reporting is just going to meals either.
But last Friday, you went to lunch with Jackie Mason. You were invited to lunch with Jackie Mason and the New York Police Commissioner, Howard Safer.
Right. That's the comedian Jackie Mason, as opposed to any other Jackies. Yeah, no, the police commissioner had been very upset about a series of articles I had done about racism in the New York City Police Department. And it was, what do they say in diplomatic circles? This was an open and frank exchange of views. And the commissioner was was fuming, actually, at my coverage. And Jackie Mason said he really wants to punch you out, but I've convinced him not to do that.
Showing that the you had shown that the police department discriminates against minority cops.
Yes, against black and Hispanic cops. And the commissioner actually has moved to appoint a Temple University to do an independent investigation of 20 years of discipline within the police department. This is a problem that many police departments around the country are having, and black and Latino and Asian officers and women have been saying for years in many police departments that they've been subjected to especially harsh treatment and discipline. And this, as far as I know, is the first independent investigation where all the books, the personnel books of the department, will be opened up to a university to study what's going on.
Although I have to smile a little when you say Temple University was hired, considering they don't seem to be allowed to say the word Mumia Abu-Jamal there.
Yes, it's an interesting choice of schools, isn't it?
Well, the New York City Police Commissioner Howard Safer was angry at your news reporting. We're going to take a look at a different kind of news that is reported around this country. A heavy dose of mayhem and fluff have become standard fare on local TV newscasts across the country, as opposed to the kind of reporting you do, Juan. And according to a new study by Rocky Mountain Media Watch Group based in Denver, Colorado, TV newscasts are relying more and more on violence and mayhem to fill their daily shows. Left by the wayside are stories on education, the environment, and other social and political issues. Here to talk about what's on TV is Paul Kleit, the director of the Rocky Mountain Media Watch, which just released the results of its annual survey of 100 TV newscasts in 55 cities across the country. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Paul.
Good morning, Amy.
Well, tell us what you found.
Well, this was our third annual survey, and we looked at large markets, medium-sized markets, small markets. A one-day snapshot. We have a network of volunteers across the country who tape their local newscasts and send it to us for analysis. And as you've indicated, the news is totally out of balance and has been for decades now. Violence totally dominates most newscasts. Almost half the news on average across the country is about violent topics: war, disaster, terrorism, crime. And among the crime coverage, which was a full third of the news, murder is the dominant type of crime we see. We don't see white-collar crime at all. You know, if a man robs a bank and they catch it on the surveillance camera, it's probably going to get on the news. But if a bank robs a man, you won't see it on local TV news. And night after night after night, this diet of violence coming into our living rooms has profound side effects throughout the country. You know, 80 million people watch their local TV news across the country. It's one of the main sources of information for people. And what's on the local TV news goes a long way to setting the agenda of what our communities are dealing with.
Do people watch the local news more than they watch the national news?
Absolutely. 30 million people, I think, watch the network news, the national network news on TV, and 80 million watch the local news. The local news has become the cash cow for stations. It's their main revenue source. And now we find stations having 5, 6, 7 hours a day of local TV news.
I noticed in your report you mentioned that, for instance, the JonBenet Ramsey story, that 36 out of 100 stations on the particular nights that you monitored them had stories, even though they had no real story, no advancement of the news in that. Could you tell us about that a little bit?
Yes. One of the nice features of this technique is that we can look and see which stories are kind of bleeding all across the country or playing all across the country. And that was one of them. There was no news in that case, but it's become such a tabloid story, the type of story that local TV just loves, especially with that videotape of the girl kind of dressed up like a woman wiggling her fanny. That video has just been burned into people's brains. And as you say, 36 of the stations ran that story. Over half the stations that night ran a story that McDonald's is considering lowering the price on their hamburgers. Now, is that really news?
Well, you know, it is true, though, when a case doesn't advance, that's news, too, especially in a case like JonBenet Ramsey, where her parents, affluent and white, didn't talk to police for such a long period of time. Even when a case doesn't advance, sometimes that is a story. The question is if the local news deals with it in that way.
Well, you know, we've been treated to a succession of tabloid murder stories over the last few years that have become dominant stories. You know, O.J. Simpson was the major story for 2 full years. On the network news, on the local news across the country. Is that the most important thing that happened in the U.S. in the last 2 years?
Well, Paul, as they say, as the viewers and readers say, tell us the good news. Were there any stations that actually were bucking the trend and were actually attempting to provide real information to the to TV viewers?
Yes, Juan, we did identify seven stations that we felt were breaking that trend. The main one was KVUE in Austin, the number one rated station in Austin that has very publicly announced new criteria for reporting crime on their local newscasts. They had a whole bunch of focus groups in their community, and people told them they were sick and tired of this sensational crime reporting they're getting from television. So unless there's a threat to the community or a threat to children or some preventive action people need to take, they will not report crime stories. And on this evening, on KVUE's newscast, there was indeed no crime reporting, even though a couple of the other Austin stations, half the news was about crime. So that's one example we can call on. There's a public television station in Minneapolis, St. Paul, KTCA, that does, it's the only public television station with a nightly local newscast. It's kind of patterned on the Lair News Hour, and it's a delightful show with in-depth looks at local issues.
You know, I thought it was interesting how you talked about this trend in local newscasts epitomized by WSVN, the number one ranked station in Miami, of using film techniques to heighten the drama of the news show.
That's definitely catching on. They're using kind of manipulative music underneath news stories like they do in the movies. They're using exploding graphics and bizarre sound effects. These are all just attention-getting devices that increase the drama and tension of the presentation, and those trends are catching on around the country. You might remember a couple of years ago that some of the hotel owners in Miami Beach pulled the plug on their cable systems because tourists who were coming to Miami would turn on their local TV news on WSVN and get terrified, be afraid to go out at night. That's no way to spend a vacation.
And how prevalent did your report find the whole issue of a cross-promotion where the news is actually used to promote the entertainment programming at the stations?
There's a lot of that going on. For example, six different Fox stations ran a long segment that was really about one of the Fox TV programs, and they presented that as if it was news. And on a couple of stations, Jay Leno appeared live talking with the anchors promoting his show that was coming up after the news. That's one of the trends, I think, to deal with the fact that people are using remote control devices now to click away from newscasts during commercial breaks and things like that. So stations are sneaking in little promos, little cross-promotions to get their messages out.
And, of course, there's also the use of videotape provided by companies, like, for example, pharmaceutical companies, and used in local newscasts to promote a drug, talking about them as a news discovery.
More and more, yes. If they have a videotape, and there's hidden cameras and surveillance cameras all over the place now, if they have videotape, it really increases the likelihood of something appearing on the news, whether or not it's newsworthy. For example, well, we mentioned the Ramsey case. That was one example, but on one station, a citizen from that city was on a vacation and noticed a rock slide in Yosemite, and that appeared on the newscast, even though it had no relevance to that local community.
Well, we want to thank you very much for joining us, Paul. If people want to get a hold of your report, Bad News, with a picture of a sheep and a TV set, Local TV News in America, where can they call?
They can call Rocky Mountain Media Watch. We're in Denver at area 303-832-7558.
That's 303-832-7558, you said?
Correct.
Well, thanks again for joining us. Paul Kleit of Rocky Mountain Media Watch in Denver, Colorado. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Well, one story that has certainly been in the news is the story of the Timothy McVeigh trial that's going on right now. And tomorrow, the defense is expected to begin its case, the defense of Timothy McVeigh. We're going to combine a couple of issues right now. We're joined by Steve Hawkins. Steve Hawkins is the director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty based in Washington, D.C. And before we get into stories of the death penalty in Texas, for example, this week four people are expected to be executed, and the case of a teenager who is facing the death penalty in Mississippi, we wanted to talk just for a minute about who the lawyers are who who were defending Timothy McVeigh. Steve Hawkins joins us in the studio at WPFW, a Pacifica station in Washington, D.C. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Steve.
Thank you, Amy. Glad to be on the show.
Good to have you. Why don't you tell us about who these attorneys are? In fact, one you're going to be giving an award to.
Yes, one of the attorneys for Timothy McVeigh is Mandy Welch, who for years directed the Texas Death Penalty Resource Center, someone who has defended numerous people on death row and has really been one of the champions in Texas trying to stop the state from killing down there. And we'll be honoring Mandy at our annual conference, which will be held this year in Houston, Texas, which is, as you know, the buckle of the death belt.
And tell us about the chief attorney, Stephen Jones, the chief defense attorney.
Steve Jones is from Oklahoma. I've had the pleasure to meet him a few times. He's worked on a number of capital cases in Oklahoma. We've consulted on a few, and he's a very good, thorough attorney. The government, however, has shed a lot of their case in the McVeigh trial. They are wrapping up, as I understand today, and the defense is expected to start putting on evidence. So by shedding witnesses and trying to move the case quickly forward, they're hoping to get a quick conviction.
What in talking to Mandy Welch and Jones, you would think normally that attorneys who have been involved in capital cases would be tend to be more, on, I guess, on the liberal political end of the spectrum. How did they get involved in the McVeigh trial?
Well, what is happening around the country, and this is, I think, no different than when Clarence Darrow took up the case of Loeb and Leopold, when there are those cases where we know that the state is going to throw everything behind seeking a capital prosecution, some of the finest attorneys in the country are stepping forward. So, for example, Judy Clark, who is right now the president of the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, is involved in representing Ted Kaczynski. And the same around the Susan Smith case with David Bruck and Judy Clark coming to her defense. So people are getting involved to some extent because they know that these are the cases where many attorneys will shy away from, will not want to be bothered, and they are really responding to the highest call of the profession.
Steve Hawkins, you mentioned Mandy Welch was working in Texas, and this week we see that four executions are expected to take place there. Reading from AP, a Bible resting on his chest, Clarence Lackey told his mother he loved her just before he was executed for raping and killing a woman whose nearly decapitated body was left in a cotton field. He was on death row for 15 years and was the second of four men to be put to death by lethal injection this week in Texas. What's happening in Texas?
What's happening is that the Attorney General has coordinated efforts and activities with the local judges. In Texas, the local county judge sets the execution date, and in the past, they would overlap so that there would be multiple people set for the same date. And, of course, that made a lot of work for the courts, both state, federal, and the Supreme Court. Well, now what the Attorney General's office has clearly done is they are coordinating with the local judges such that no two dates are set on the same day. So therefore, we see this Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday spreading out of executions. And, of course, that is designed to really have methodological killing where the chance of a state or federal court stopping the execution because of simply lack of time to really give it thorough review, all the issues raised in the pleadings, that's not going to happen. And so the courts are able to sort of dispense with last-minute appeals, and the state is able to move on with the execution.
I know from past articles that I've done that Harris County is the death capital of the United States. Is the same district attorney still there, still promoting this record number of death penalty cases?
He is. His name is Johnny Holmes, and he is still the district attorney, very proud of his incredible record for seeking the death penalty in nearly every case in which eligibility could be determined in Texas. That's why we're going to have our conference there this year, the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. We're actually going to be down there protesting in front of his office on June 20th. And things continue to be very bad with respect to innocence, questions of innocence in Texas. Recently, Adape Guerra, who spent a number of years, over 10 years on death row in Texas, put on death row by Johnny Holmes for allegedly killing a Houston police officer, was released and promptly deported back to Mexico. But he became nearly the 70th innocent person released from death row.
Steve Hawkins, we're going to ask you to stay with us. We're going to break right now, but then we're going to go into a case that you've been quite involved with. We're going to go down to Mississippi and speak about the case of teenager Azi Kambuli, who faces the death penalty. Steve Hawkins, director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. One of the first things that the African National Congress did after being elected to power in South Africa was to abolish the death penalty. But about the same time that Nelson Mandela was decrying executions as barbaric, a young South African woman by the name of Busisiwe Chabeli came to Mississippi with her 15-year-old son to study psychology at Jackson State University. Now her teenage son, Azi Kambuli, is languishing in a Mississippi jail, facing a politically ambitious prosecutor who's announced his intention to seek the death penalty against him. We're joined by two people from Mississippi, Charles Tisdale, journalist with the Jackson Advocate. He is publisher and editor of the paper in Jackson, and Busisiwe Chabeli, the mother of Azi Kambuli. But before we go to each of them in Mississippi, I wanted to ask Steve Hawkins, who's still with us, director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, who's quite involved with Azi Kambuli's case, if you can just lay out for us a thumbnail sketch of what this case is about. What is Azi Kambuli facing?
Azi is facing the death penalty for a very extremely minor role in a criminal situation in which he wasn't even present when the victim was killed. He was 17 years old at the time and is one of the many juveniles facing the death penalty in the United States. And I can certainly leave it for others to fill in more details.
What was, though, the case about? Can you talk about the woman who was killed and how she was killed?
Well, the case involves a woman who was kidnapped by an older youth who had befriended Azi. Azi came to the United States at 15 years old to Jackson, Mississippi, which is not necessarily the most cosmopolitan area in the country. And he found that his high school peers ridiculed him, made fun of his mannerisms, his accent, his clothing. And so he tried, like many youth, to fit in and found himself running with a older group of kids, much more streetwise. And that led ultimately to a young woman being kidnapped in a carjacking, and she was taken out of Jackson into a wooded area and shot to death. Ozzy wasn't present when the shooting occurred. He was back in a car. He wasn't even knowledgeable that anyone had been killed. But he was picked up about a week later, and from the very beginning has tried to be helpful to the police and trying to locate the body and what have you. But the prosecutor has sought the death penalty against Ozzy, thinking that because he was a stranger in the country, that there wouldn't be much support for him, and that it would be an easy political victory seeking the capital prosecution for this child. And so that prompted the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty to get very active and to build support for him, both nationally and internationally.
Yes, I'd like to ask Charles Tisdale, the editor and publisher of the Jackson Advocate. There was the actual killer in this case. I understand his name is Santonio Berry. What happened to him, and why is he not facing the death penalty in this case?
Well, I presume that Mr. Kitchens found that two is better than one. So by ensnaring Kambuli, he would get the death penalty for one and the other in jail for the rest of his life. You have to understand that the policy of the current governor is to eliminate as many African-American young black males as possible. In fact, he made a statement when he took office that he wanted Mississippi to be the capital of capital punishment, which means that as many young black males as he can kill, he wants to do so. And he has some strange and sinister people to help him carry out his edict.
Now, Santonio Berry, the man who has pled out in this case and now has gotten life without parole, is that right?
Oh, well, he's gotten life without parole, but more than that, in exchange for his life without parole, he claims all kinds of fantastic things that he never claimed at the beginning when he was arrested. He now claims that Ozzy gave him the gun. Now, where would Ozzy get a gun? You know, he was typically, he's more like a young English schoolboy than like a gang member. Anything of that kind. He's very gentle, and his mother will, I'm sure, tell you, one of the quietest people you've ever seen. But, you know, peer pressure, the pressure of coming from a foreign country to Mississippi, which is also a foreign country, and having no connections with people of his age, or even people that he could feel comfortable with, is the reason for his being in this situation now.
I'd like to ask Ozzy's mother, Bosisiwe Chabeli, who's with us also, how, when this first happened, what was your immediate, how authorities treated you, and what were was your immediate recourse when your son was first arrested and charged with this crime?
Well, my first reaction was absolute shock, because this was definitely not something that I thought Ozzy could do. And we were subsequently told by the detectives who came to the house that we would be able to talk to him on the, I think it was the 7th of February. He would be allowed to make his first phone call, and we could talk to him, and then we would be able to make arrangements for maybe representation. But, well, that never took place. And the first time we saw him was when he appeared in court that morning. And then we went on to try and get a public defender for him.
How is this? I mean, it's an impossible question to ask you, how this has been for you, Busi Chabeli. Coming from South Africa to study here for a few years and your son being arrested. First, did he have representation when he was first questioned by the police?
No, he did not. He did not have any representation. And when he appeared in court, my husband was there, and he was trying to get the judge's attention to say, I am here, may I approach so I can explain, because as he had no knowledge whether we would be able to retain a lawyer for him or whether he had to get a public defender. He had no clue, absolutely. But my husband was never allowed to do that. And then subsequent to that, I think they had an indictment process that took place. Santonio Berry and Rudy Rhodes were in court, represented by public defenders, and my son could not be there because even at the time he still did not have a public defender. We had been moved from office to office and not able to get a public defender. You know, papers not being available, papers had not been signed, the judge had not made a decision. So it took us a long time. It took us probably almost 2 weeks to get a public defender for him.
I'd like to ask Charles Tisdale, there's been, over the years in Jackson, Mississippi, a tremendous voting rights and civil rights movement, and yet you're saying that at this stage in the state, things are going backward in terms of how African Americans are treated before the criminal justice system. How is that possible?
It's possible because of the class war that's going on between the blacks who've taken advantage, middle-class blacks who've taken advantage of the struggles of the 60s to empower and enrich themselves at the expense of the underclass who have nothing, not even a job. Here in Jackson, African-Americans make 23% of what white people make. And tellingly, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, Mr. Thurber, pointed out his reaction to Jackson, Mississippi, after coming from South Africa, serving for the Journal 15 years there. He said he left America for South Africa, and he left the new America of South Africa for South Africa when he came to Mississippi. Mm-hmm. What he essentially meant is that Mississippi is the old South Africa, with all of its ways and mores, but it's a class struggle, pure and simple, between those who have and have not. The NAACP did not open its mouth except to join the side of the white folks who want to hang, in practical terms, young Ozzy, the head of the NAACP, and other women marched down in front of the Capitol, calling for a quicker death penalty. I thought it was shameful, but that's the situation here.
You know, as you talk about the state of Mississippi today, we had to inject another voice, and that is the voice of Nina Simone. We're talking about Ozzie Kambuya in Mississippi.
The name of this tune is Mississippi Goddamn. I mean every word of it. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. Alabama's got me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows. Stand the pressure much longer. Somebody say a prayer. Alabama's gotten me so upset. Tennessee made me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Mississippi Goddamn. This is a show tune, but the show hasn't been written for it yet. Hound dogs on my trail, school children sitting in jail, black cat cross my path, I think every day is gonna be my last.
friend of mine. We all gonna get it in due time. I don't belong here, I don't belong there. I've even stopped believing in prayer.
Nina Simone singing Mississippi Goddamn. We're talking to Charles Tisdale, editor and publisher of the Jackson Advocate in Jackson, Mississippi, as well as Busi Chabeli, the mother of Azi Kambuli, who faces the death penalty. Steve Hawkins is also with us from Washington, D.C., director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, which is quite involved in Azi Kambuli's case. I wanted to ask Busi Chabeli, what is the prosecution attempting to do right now? Are they putting pressure on you to plea bargain?
Not to my knowledge. Not to my knowledge, I know that Aziz's lawyers have been talking to the McGill family's lawyers, and we haven't been feeling any pressure. In fact, I think there was a bit of a surprise when Santana Berry was given the plea bargain for life and in return for him to implicate Azi, because I think we and most people felt like Azi would be a more likely candidate to get a deal, you know, based on the facts and what had taken place.
I'd like to bring Steve Hawkins back into the conversation here. What about this whole issue of capital punishment for young people in this country, for juveniles? What is the record on this issue in other countries? How does the rest of the world look at this?
And how many are on death row in this country?
Well, right now we have close to 45 to 50 juveniles on death row, people who went there under the age of 18 for crimes they committed under the age of 18. Very few countries in the world are putting children, sending children to death row. We are one of only five countries known this decade to have done so. The others are Yemen, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. So the U.S. record on this is terrible. Mississippi still has on the books the ability to capitally prosecute 13-year-olds, and they tried to do so last year with a 13-year-old. So, It is one of the most egregious examples of human rights violations going on in the world today, and then the U.S. is right at the leadership of that.
And doesn't the United Nations actually on record opposing any kind of capital punishment for young people?
Yes. The latest document is the U.N. Convention on the Rights of the Child, which, as I understand, having spoken with a human rights scholar just recently, there are only two countries in the world that have not ratified the U.N. Convention on the Rights of the Child. One is the Cook Islands in the South Pacific, and the other is the United States. And the reason for the hang-up in the United States is that the convention emphatically declares that the children are to be protected, that they cannot be subject to capital punishment, or for that matter, life without parole. But Russia has signed on to the convention. China has signed on to it. They don't even execute juveniles in China.
Busi Chabeli, as we wrap up, what are you asking for right now in terms of support around the country? And when do you expect the trial to begin if Azi doesn't plea bargain?
We expect to go to trial on June 16. And in terms of support, I think that, first of all, prayers would help a lot. But also just for people to write in, to the district attorney, to local newspapers, to Jackson Advocate, the Clarion Ledger, expressing their views on the whole situation, because I feel that it's overkill, it's overreaction. For like Steve said, for the minor role that Azi had in the whole situation, and we're not in any way, you know, trying to take away from the pain that the McGills are feeling. We hurt for them, we pray for them all the time, but I don't think that Mr. Kitchens should be allowed to take Azi's life away in the way that he's trying to do. It is not justice.
June 16th, is that the anniversary of the Soweto uprising?
It is ironic, yes. June 16th is the uprising of the Soweto riots, and I'm not sure what it means. It could mean any of two things. And so it's very interesting. It could be Freedom Day. It could be anything.
Well, we want to thank you all very much for joining us. We will continue to follow this case. We've been talking with Busi Chabeli, the mother of Azi Kambuli, facing the death penalty in Mississippi. We've also been speaking with Charles Tisdale, who is publisher and editor of the Jackson Advocate, and Steve Hawkins, director of the National Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, based in Washington, D.C. Juan, thanks very much for being with us today. Next up, we're going to talk to a woman who is facing 55 years in prison because she had an affair in the Air Force. Stay with us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Facing growing outrage, the Air Force has delayed the court-martial trial of the country's first female B-52 bomber pilot, Lieutenant Kelly Flynn. The Air Force said it needed time to examine a request to dismiss the case in return for an honorable discharge. Lieutenant Flynn faces charges of adultery, lying to investigators, and disobeying an order in connection with two love affairs the Air Force says she had. The case of 26-year-old Lieutenant Flynn has not only generated criticism of the military's rules against adultery and certain types of romantic relationships, but also the way those rules are applied. Many victims and women's groups say the regulations are disproportionately applied to women. Lieutenant Krista Davis, a classmate of Flynn's at the Air Force Academy and a communications officer at Barksdale Air Force Base in Shreveport, Louisiana, also says she's the victim of military justice system that discriminates against women. She faces 55 years in prison on charges related to a relationship she had with a married officer, although she says she didn't know he was married at the time. I spoke to Lieutenant Davis last night because she didn't want to speak during working hours and asked her to describe her case.
First of all, I'll go with the similarities of our case, and then I'll just divert to me personally. We're obviously both women. We were both involved in adulterous affairs, and we're both classmates out of the academy, so there are similarities. But we diverged. I didn't know, I don't know about Kelly, but I didn't know that my lover and father of my child was married. Aside from that, in the Air Force, I had a supervisor that didn't particularly care for me, my race or my sex, and he set about destroying my career. So basically I went through my chain of command but ended up blowing the whistle or reporting my whole entire chain of command up to General Ford, to the Pentagon, and also to Congress on a couple of occasions. So because I did that, the Air Force retaliated and brought me up on pretext charges or Mickey Mouse charges during the time frame that the investigator was actually at my base.
Explain some of the counts of discrimination that you charge the military with.
Okay. There's a couple of comments where he refers to Air Force Academy women as a coven of witches. And that story is basically that he had gone through communication school with these women, simultaneous class. And he overheard them plotting to get men kicked out. So he's always thought of these women as the most evil women he's ever known, a coven of witches. And so he would relate this story to me, as well as other female academy grads, graduates at the place where I work, 8th Air Force. With regard to a black editorial writer, Clarence Page, he read some sort of editorial he wrote and said that he deserved a good old-fashioned Mississippi ass-whipping. These are pretty blatant. Well, another thing that he did was he helped my commander cancel an assignment I had to Japan, and that was in January of 96. I got in, and they started in on paperwork with me. They gave me a letter of reprimand, an unfavorable information file, a bad report right before my captain's board, despite the fact that I had a successful exercise and no mission failures. And his justification for giving me a bad report before my captain's board was that I was emotional. And this, of course, was all during the time of my pregnancy. I was pregnant from March of 96 through December 96. So the bad report, not being able to write the captain's board, and those are all under investigation at this point in time. And then, you know, he would talk about higher-ranking women as being stupid. He would call them stupid. He would go on and on about how stupid they were. And just other things that he would do to other people, be they black or white. Out of 40 witnesses, they weren't all black, and they weren't all women. There were, you know, he hurt other people as well, but I just happened to be the person that he put paperwork on. It actually destroyed my career.
How did they deal with your pregnancy?
I was harassed throughout my pregnancy. I didn't want to give birth here because it's a negative environment for me. And I also had no support network here. And a good friend of mine was telling me about a birthing center that she had gone to in Sugar Land, Texas, actually Richwood, Texas. She wanted me to come check it out. So I did, and I saw the midwife there. And at that point in time, the midwife checked me, and I was dilated. I was actually in an early stage of labor. And so the nurse and midwife informed or faxed back information about me being dilated and unable to return to work, and the Air Force put me in AWOL status. They knew where I was. They threatened to send an aircraft after me. They yanked my clearance, and they basically cut my pay by $900.
And so you documented all this. You charged them with discrimination, and what did they end up countercharging?
They countercharged with the time the investigator was there. They countercharged that dereliction of duty, cruel and indecent language by letter, and I'll go into that. That's kind of me coming of an officer. They charged me with failure to inform my whereabouts when I was in labor. A failure to go, which is being late, and they said that I lied to a medical doctor about the reason that I was in Texas in order to get convalescent leave in order to cover the time frame that they put me in AWOL status. And so those are the charges against me, and that's 55 years worth of charges.
If you're court-martialed and found guilty, you could go to jail for 55 years?
Right.
How do you answer those charges?
I don't. Those charges are all pretext charges, so I would answer of not guilty. That's a temper tantrum by the Air Force. That's an anger at the fact that I actually exposed racism and sexism. The charges, the ones that are like 45 years, there's 9 specifications of willfully disobeying a superior officer. That's the harshest punishment you can get. They're five years apiece. Mostly occur, they charge me during the time that the Inspector General is there. In other words, while I'm actually talking to him and the witnesses are being reviewed by this person. They are things like not preparing a squadron Christmas party. They say things like not preparing a temporary duty leave report, not doing an additional duty roster. These are all five piece.
We're talking to Lieutenant Krista Davis, who is involved with a battle against the Air Force. She is the second woman who faces prison for a number of charges, including, and this we haven't talked about yet, the fact that you had an affair. Can you explain that, Krista?
I got involved with my former English instructor at the academy. He was my instructor in 90. We did not have an affair at that point in time. We weren't involved. I became involved with him in 95, and we got into this relationship, and April of 96, I found out he was married, and I broke off the relationship. I actually turned him in that same day to his commander, but I didn't identify myself. It was an anonymous turn-in, and I said, you know, I don't want to deal with him. I don't want to be connected to him ever again in my life. So I basically left, and 2 months later, I found out that I was pregnant with his child, and I informed him, and he, of course, tossed the line, you know, I've got to get divorced and so on and so forth. I need to explain that he was in his own apartment. You know, so this is a fairly deceptive setup in the first place. He was on his own apartment, so it wasn't like he was living with his wife. And, you know, I knew because, you know, at a point in time, I mean, I was at his place quite a few times, so I knew, you know, his setup, if you will. Anyway, I found out I'm pregnant, and he throws the line, of course, that he's going to get divorced, and of course he's not. The last time I saw him was September of 96, and I basically went to talk to him about the child. All I wanted him to do was take care of the child. You know, there wasn't a need for exposing anyone or turning anyone for adultery. And you know, he, at that point in time, he was really, was really frustrated. He did not want to take responsibility. You know, he lied again, said he was going to get divorced, and I told him he was lying. Why don't you just leave me alone, Krista? You know, he had picked out names for the baby, but he told me I should have killed the baby. He would have done anything to get me to kill it, and I was 6 months pregnant at this time. And, you know, it was just a massive deterioration. So at that same day, I got immunity from the superintendent, a three-star general at the Air Force Academy, from persecution of adultery in exchange for a statement that I made against him. So that happened. And I guess I was just, I mean, my pregnancy was horrific. You know, my career had, you know, crashing around, you know, down around my ankles and so on and so forth. What I did was I had asked Greg if he was going, his name is Major Greg Russell, if he was going to tell his wife. I mean, I thought it was significant that he tell her that, you know, I was going to have his kid, you know, for obvious reasons. And, of course, he said it was none of her business. And, you know, this all made me very angry. I mean, here he was. You know, basically getting away with murder, as I saw it. You know, he wasn't taking responsibility. He had no intention of doing so one way or the other. And what I did was I wanted to get back at him. And what I did was I wrote her letters describing graphically myself and him and the fact that we had a child and she was going to be taking care of his child. And one of the reasons how I found out was I actually spoke to her. I spoke to her, and that's how I knew that, you know, he was still married. You know, he was married, period. I didn't even know he was married, but anyway. So I wrote her, and of course she confronted him, and she was very angry, and eventually they divorced in December of 96 as well. And so that was like, that's where the charges of conduct unbecoming, cruel and indecent language come from. I use the F word, so that makes me a prison candidate.
And so what exactly are they charging with in connection with this affair? And are they charging him with the same crimes, I guess?
No, they aren't. I get cruel and indecent language, four specifications. I forget how much prison time that is. I think it's a few years. But with him, he got a letter of reprimand. He got a slap on the wrist, despite the fact that a child came out of that. They, in accordance with, for all my effort, one way or the other, they issued a no-contact order against me, knowing that he was, you know, at least the alleged father of my child. And that was a setup. That was to force me to, if I had filed a paternity suit against him without their orders, then without their permission, what would have happened is I would have been in violation of an order, you know, just Kelly Flynn, basically. But what I did do with that was I asked permission. You know, I went forth and I said, you know, listen, he's this baby's father and so on and so forth. But, you know, he was never held accountable, and to this day he still paid no child support. He was deemed insane, all charges dismissed against him one way or the other, and he's returned to the academy staff earning $65,000 a year, and this child goes unsupported. So, I mean, I just got the results of the paternity test yesterday. I had to really force that and chase after him to get that because he fought it tooth and nail, this insane man, if you will.
How did he get classified as insane?
They sent him before an Air Force Sanity Board, and they said that, you know, he was a, you know, had problems with his personality and eating disorders and stuff like that. It's just a cop-out. It was a cover-up Sanity Board. They were trying to sweep a sex scandal under the rug. I mean, they didn't want anybody to know anything about the situation. His attorney threatened my attorney, threatened to release the letters that I wrote to the as well as they threatened to, she threatened to release, like, my performance reports about what a bad officer I was. And that's all on, you know, that's the record anyway. That's the Pentagon, so the public can get that if they want to, if they wish it. My charges in my reports are open record. I will show people why, you know, they've destroyed my career. I mean, I actually have lines in my report that say I'm emotional, written during the time of my pregnancy, or, you know, just lines like that. No real justification for why I was not promoted or given a bad report.
So right now you remain in the Air Force, is that right?
That's correct.
But unlike Kelly Flynn, who is asking for an honorable discharge, what are you asking for?
Well, I tried that. I asked for an assignment. You know, they canceled the assignment in order to destroy my career. I asked to be separated due to my pregnancy. That way you don't have to force the Air Force to accommodate you one way or the other. And then I asked for my resignation. And I put in for my resignation, I think, in October, November time frame, and they stopped it. All resignation stops when you're brought up on criminal charges. So they put me under investigation in order to stop my resignation. The New York Daily News says today that I haven't put in my formal request, a RILO, a resignation in lieu of further administrative charges. But that's just a dangle, a carrot, you know, that I'd ask for it and then they would smash me and tell me no, just like they did Kelly Flynn. I mean, it's just a ploy. And basically, too, they don't want to be exposed for quite a few things. I've yet to get the results of my investigation back. I mean, I'm still waiting. And, you know, it is reason enough to put a court-martial off. I mean, they need to ante up. I mean, if this isn't steeped in racism and sexism, then answer the questions, you know, to answer my questions, answer my allegations.
So when is your court-martial scheduled for?
There's no date. I still have a preliminary hearing to get through. And the Air Force will cover up, too. They will always say, we could reprimand her or dismiss the charges or whatever. When they bring you up on formal court-martial charges, it's 99.9% that they're going to court-martial you and basically go for that conviction. They have other options that they could have done with me. I mean, I'm an Academy grad. Do you think that, you know, if my commander told me, do this, I just said, no, I'm not going to do it. I mean, that's how they want to make it seem, like it's very cut and dry. I should have, my record should be full of letters of counseling, letter of reprimand saying, you should be doing this, you should have done this, this is wrong, you're bad. You don't just bring someone up on court-martial charges, especially not for not planning the squadron Christmas party. That's not, like I said, it wasn't so cut and dry, and it's not like they make it sound, but they can do that. Just like they said, I lied to a medical doctor. I didn't lie to her, but they can say I did. I mean, that's just the way it is in the Air Force.
What message do you think your case, as well as the case of Kelly Flynn, sends to women thinking about joining the military or women already in the military?
It's very dangerous. This is a dangerous place for women right now, and it's a dangerous place for men who actually support women and look at women as partners in the military right now, because the signal that they're sending out is that we don't want you. And you know, it's a very traditional place. So the people who are in power are used to women taking a supportive role, a role of child rearing, and not an aggressive partnership role, authoritative role. So it's very dangerous. I mean, it's not even about you being an aggressive woman or one that's a confident one about yourself, but just being a woman. I mean, there have been other women who, you know, who have been brought up on charges who don't necessarily fit the authoritative, aggressive, groundbreaking mold. I don't know about Lieutenant Colonel Karen, too. I know that she shot herself because they dismissed her after 19 years of service. They could have forced her into retirement.
We've been speaking with Lieutenant Krista Davis, who faces 55 years in prison for a love affair she had in the military with a man she did not realize was married at the time. She has since had a son. His name is Christoph, and he is just about more than a year old. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin, our assistant producer and engineer in New York, Errol Maitland. In Washington, our engineer, Andy York. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!